Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today I'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the escalating tension between the US and North Korea following the North's UN ambassador Ri Yong-ho's assertion that President Trump's comments at the UN that he will totally destroy North Korea and his subsequent tweets that the North Korean leadership won't be around much longer constitute a declaration of war by the US, giving the North Koreans, quote, every right to make countermeasures. Charles Armstrong, a professor of history and director of the Center for Korean Research at Columbia University and author of Tyranny of the Weak, North Korea and the World, joins us to discuss the nature of the North Korean regime as a mixture of politics and spirituality, whose subjects are taught from childhood that they come from the birthplace of civilization and are indoctrinated with the Juche self-reliance philosophy, a nationalistic religious cult led by the dynastic Kim family, who the North Korean people believe are the royal lineage of Tangun, the mythical founder of Korea 4,500 years ago. Then we get an assessment of the nuclear threat from North Korea following their recent announcement of their intention to shoot a missile with an H-bomb on it to be detonated somewhere over the Pacific. Philip Coyle, who was Associate Director for National Security and International Affairs in the White House Office of Science and Technology Policy and Assistant Secretary of Defense and Director of Operational Test and Evaluation in the Department of Defense, joins us. We'll discuss the likelihood of reckless rhetoric leading to a nuclear exchange in Northeast Asia. Then finally, we'll look into Sunday's extraordinary display of solidarity and indignation expressed by NFL players and owners in response to Trump's crude attack on Colin Kaepernick for taking a knee during the national anthem, and the president's contention that the NFL was losing fans because the game was not violent enough. Ben Carrington, a professor at USC's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism and author of Race, Sports, and Politics, joins us to discuss Trump's dog whistle to his angry white voters that if the mostly black players in the NFL, quote, want the privilege of making millions of dollars, they should not be allowed to disrespect our great American flag. If not, you're fired. And joining us now is Charles Armstrong, a professor of history and the director of the Center for Korean Research at Columbia University. His books include The North Korean Revolution, 1945 to 1950, A History of the Peninsula, simply titled The Koreas, Korean Society, Civil Society, Democracy, and the State. And his latest book is Tyranny of the Weak, North Korea and the World. Welcome to Background Briefing, Charles Armstrong.
Good to be with you again.
And it's a very grim time, and I must say that the idea of these insults being traded between President Trump and Kim Jong-un, I don't think Donald Trump has any concept of how dangerous it is in terms of the Kim being the head of a country with an extraordinary belief system, which I'd like to have you explain to our audience, the Juche philosophy, the idea that school children in North Korea are taught from the day one that they are the center of civilization, that the mythical god king Tangun is the Kim dynasty, the heirs to the founder of the country 4,500 years ago. And it wasn't so long ago that they took out all references to Marxist-Leninism from their constitution, which they only put in to get aid from communist China and the Soviet Union. So it seems like everything about North Korea, the way we see it as this hermit kingdom Stalinist state, is completely wrong. And most of all, I don't believe that our president has any concept of what he's doing when he's taunting this leader.
I think it's fair to say that President Trump doesn't have a lot of clear knowledge of a lot of things that he does and talks about. But certainly when it comes to foreign affairs, we don't seem to have the most well-briefed man in charge of the country at the moment. North Koreans have always insulted American leaders going back to the Korean War. But this is the first time that we've seen an American president play the North Koreans at their own game of insulting them in return. So far, it's been a war of words, but words can have a way of escalating into action. And I fear that we're getting close to that point, that insults intended perhaps to bolster a domestic constituency or to make oneself look tough are going to have to be backed by action, and that could be extremely dangerous, if not catastrophic, for the Korean Peninsula and the entire East Asian region.
So when the North Korean ambassador said today, Ambassador Ri Yong-ho said that essentially that Donald Trump had declared war on the United States by declaring in front of the United Nations that he could totally destroy North Korea, and then tweeting later that the leadership would, quote, not be around much longer. I mean, frankly, that's pretty unambiguous in any case. So even if you're not paranoid, you're going to take that seriously, aren't you?
One would think so. This certainly looks on the face of it as a threat to destroy North Korea as a country. This is something that the North Koreans have been saying since the Korean War, that the intention of the U.S. has been to destroy it. Most American presidents have been cautious and sensible enough to try to, although talking firmly, to assure the North Koreans that their intention is not to destroy the country. But if the U.S. president is saying in front of the entire world at the United Nations that the U.S. does intend to get rid of their leadership and totally destroy the country is a term that is actually much more chilling than that. It's almost a sort of genocidal threat, you know, not just getting rid of the leadership. What does it mean to totally destroy a country? Well, this is exactly playing into the North Korean propaganda playbook. They don't have to make up this threat that the U.S. is out to destroy their country. They can simply play the clip of Trump's speech at the UN, and North Koreans take this seriously. We're treading into very dangerous ground at this point.
Well, let's talk a little about, since you're a student of North Korea, and you've written about North Korea in your recent book, Tyranny of the Weak, North Korea and the World, in the sense that Tyranny of the Weak, but nevertheless, they've just exploded an H-bomb, and the idea that Trump is taunting somebody who the North Korean people see as a kind of god king. They see him as a part of this royal lineage going back 4,500 years, and that his father was born on the mythical mountain where Tangun, the founder of Korea, comes from. And I want to get an understanding from you about this philosophy of self-reliance called Juche and this kind of nationalistic religious cult that Kim is the leader of.
Yes, Juche is translated as self-reliance or independence, and that's been the kind of official slogan in North Korea since the late 60s. But really, it's much more than economic self-reliance. It's about a very firm, almost one might say fanatical nationalism that is centered around the veneration, the cult, if you will, of the great leader and his family. This has grown and grown over the last 50 years, and now we're in the third generation of Kim. There is an almost religious aura around the Kim family. It can be a serious crime to deface the image of one of the Kims if you're caught folding a newspaper in the wrong way and creasing the portrait of the leader. You can go to jail, this sort of thing. So, you know, it's like insulting the Pope for a devout Catholic or the Quran for a devout Muslim. It's a very serious thing to insult the North Korean leader, whatever we may actually think of him. The North Koreans take this insult to their leader, I think, quite seriously. And obviously Kim Jong-un takes this sort of affront to his image quite seriously as well. North Korea is not just a holdover of Stalinism. It's been around now 25 years after the Soviet Union has collapsed. And so they have a highly nationalistic, centralized political system that has managed to survive quite some time after the end of the Cold War. We shouldn't underestimate its resilience and longevity, however strange it may be to us. And in certain respects, it's more reminiscent of the wartime Japanese cult of the emperor. When I was in North Korea several years ago, I saw slogans that said, "We will defend our leader to the death, and we will be human bombs to defend the country," which is almost exactly word for word the kinds of slogans that you saw in Japan during World War II, also not coincidentally perhaps directed against the American enemy. And under Kim Jong-un, North Korea has developed this new slogan called the Paektu Bloodline, which is that the Paektu Mountain, the holy mountain where Kim Jong-un's father was allegedly born, which traces the Kim family leaders all the way back to the mythical founder of the Korean First Kingdom, the demigod Tangun, back 5,000 years ago. So this is a really very powerful, almost cultish regime that is not going to fall easily and is very, very sensitive, to say the least, of any affronts to its sovereignty and to the defamation of its leader.
Well, Kim Jong-un, after Trump's speech at the UN threatening to totally destroy North Korea, did deliver a national address where he basically said, you know, this is an attack on me, which is also an attack on you. I am the country. And there's no doubt about that, right? The people honestly see this guy. What are the percentage of the North Korean people that would die for this man?
Well, it's very hard to say. Obviously, not everybody completely believes the propaganda, and you would be in a great deal of physical harm if you ever spoke out criticizing the leadership. But certainly, this is what North Koreans are educated in practically from birth, to revere the leader, to be grateful to him for giving you this world to live in, for defending the country and allowing the survival of Korea and you personally. This is very different from what you had, say, in the Soviet Union in the latter days when there was a great deal of disillusionment. There's certainly some disillusionment, but I think it's fair to say that the majority of people in North Korea feel very strongly supportive of the regime and certainly would want to defend their country if it felt threatened and attacked by outside forces. And they are constantly bombarded with messages that the U.S. is their primary enemy against whom they must defend themselves. So even if the U.S. attacked and even if the regime broke down, it's not clear to me that we would simply be able to install a new regime in North Korea. I mean, in the worst or perhaps best-case scenario of a regime collapse, we could still have an insurgency, it seems to me, that could go on for quite some time. So I wouldn't be too sanguine, even if we could somehow see a collapse of the regime without enormous loss of life, and it's not clear to me how that could happen, that won't be the end of the story by any means.
Well, as much as the U.S. is the enemy, and now the North Koreans are saying that since Trump has declared war on North Korea, therefore we reserve the right to enact countermeasures, and if the bombers fly up again off our coast, as they did the other day, we can shoot them down. We reserve the right to shoot them down. So they're already putting down a marker. But as you pointed out, Charles Armstrong, that America's been the enemy since the Korean War. But throughout history, Korea has identified itself as being the victim of both Japan and China. So there's no love lost, as far as I know, between China and North Korea.
Yes, I think that's correct. We shouldn't consider that China and North Korea are friends, as they put it in their own propaganda. North Korea is really very suspicious of everyone, including the Chinese, whom they see as having hegemonic ambitions on the Korean Peninsula. Their strategic allies at the moment, both China and North Korea, see their alliance as strategically beneficial to them, but it's not clear how much China would really come to the support of North Korea, and it's not at all clear that China has the influence to tell North Korea to stop with its weapons and missile production or in any way tell North Korea what to do. North Korea is, again, one of the most fiercely independent countries that we can find on Earth, and no one, including the Chinese, who theoretically have a huge economic leverage over them, can really make them do what they don't want to do.
So is there, I mean, as far as I know, there's nothing you can do. And in fact, Stephen Bannon, of course, mentioned this in an interview with the American Prospect that contributed to his firing, where he said, you know, they've got us. We can't do anything militarily because the South Koreans in Seoul are held hostage to a North Korean conventional attack that could wipe out Seoul. So they've got us, to quote Bannon. So everybody sort of said, well, there's nothing you can do. The Chinese aren't going to let the place collapse. That's why they trade with them, because they don't want refugees on their border. They don't want the American army on the Yalu River, et cetera, et cetera. So even if there were a collapse or some military action, and as you say, there's a likelihood that they'd fight on forever in a guerrilla war, is there any, the only possibility to end this regime, as far as I can tell, would be some kind of a Chinese invasion, but that's not in the cards, is it? And even then, I don't see how that would work. In other words, the Chinese are not going to let the South Koreans take over the North with the Americans on their border again, as they did when they entered the Korean War.
I think that's correct. I don't think the Chinese want North Korea to collapse. They don't want U.S. troops on their border again, as they were in 1950. They might agree to some sort of partition of post-Kim North Korea, but I think that's getting way ahead of ourselves. I think we need to be concerned about the possibility of war breaking out accidentally, as it were, or through an escalation of actions such as U.S. sending bombers very close to North Korea or even over North Korean territory and then being shot down and then the U.S. retaliating. And we need to consider that North Korea does see itself at a strategic disadvantage, so it may see that if all else looks lost, they might have no choice but to strike out first. So we're talking about, you know, millions of people in South Korea and elsewhere being held hostage. So there's no easy way out of this unless we get back to some sort of a diplomatic negotiation. And unfortunately, neither side is allowing much space for that to move forward. We may be slouching towards some sort of military conflict that, in fact, neither side wants, but may not be avoidable. I hope that's not the case, because we really must find a peaceful solution to this in order to this crisis, in order to stave off a catastrophe.
So how would you put this situation in terms of Donald Trump's insults to Kim and by extension to the entire North Korean people, since they identify him as a kind of God King, in the context of the Asian cultural propensity to save face or want to save face, in other words, not to directly insult people, that you know, this is a cultural norm, not just in Korea, as far as I understand.
Well, certainly it's a grave insult and something that should be avoided, to insult someone so directly into his face like this. Of course, the North Koreans have done this to the U.S. and South Korea, but there's a kind of aura of sacredness around the Kim family, around the leader, that I think Koreans in the North take great offense to. I don't think this is the way to resolve this problem by any means, and it simply makes the situation much worse. The Chinese are also unhappy with the direction North Korea has taken, but their approach has been to on the surface claim friendship and solidarity, but behind the scenes really try to push North Korea very hard to take another tactic to make different decisions. The few times that we have seen some progress on the North Korean nuclear issue, it's been by accepting the other side as a legitimate negotiating partner and working some sort of agreement that gives benefit to the North Koreans as well as to the U.S. side. Unfortunately, President Trump is quite adept and fond of insulting all sorts of people. In this case, I think it can be very dangerous, not because of the insults themselves, but the way they could inflame passions and lead to actions that might lead us down a very unfortunate path.
Well, just in summing up here today, Charles Armstrong, it would seem to me that we're heading in the direction of more tension, more insult. We have serious problems in this country with health care. Puerto Rico, a part of the United States, is in desperate shape. We have a president who is ignoring the plight of his own citizens and the future of their health care, and spending his time insulting Kim Jong-un and basketball and football stars here in the United States. So I'm pretty skeptical that there's going to be a sea change here and we're going to work towards diplomacy. So tell me I'm wrong.
Well, I hope you are wrong. I hope that, perhaps the best we can expect is that President Trump might get distracted by something else and not pay attention to the insult war that he's in the midst of with Kim Jong-un, rather than change tack himself and leave the diplomacy to the diplomats. There's certainly quite a bit that Trump has going on, and quite a few other people he's in the process of insulting, and many other priorities for this country that you would think the administration should be paying more attention to. And my hope is still that we can stave off a crisis or stave off a catastrophe and try to resolve this crisis through a peaceful means. If there is one thing we can say about this president, he is rather unpredictable, so he may yet surprise us in a positive way, I hope.
Well, on that note, Charles Armstrong, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
You're welcome.
And again, I've been speaking with Charles Armstrong, who's a professor of history and the director of the Center for Korean Research at Columbia University. His books include The North Korea Revolution, 1945 to 1950, A History of the Peninsula, simply titled The Koreas, Korean Society, Civil Society, Democracy and the State. And his latest book is Tyranny of the Weak, North Korea and the World. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back getting an assessment of the nuclear threat from North Korea following their recent announcement to fire an H-bomb into the Pacific. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Philip Coyle, who was Associate Director for National Security and International Affairs in the White House Office of Science and Technology Policy and Assistant Secretary of Defense and Director of Operational Test and Evaluation in the Department of Defense. With 40 years' experience in national security research, development, and testing matters, he is currently a Senior Science Fellow at the Center for Arms Control and Nonproliferation and the co-author of The Challenges of Nuclear Nonproliferation. Welcome to Background Briefing. Philip Coyle.
Good to be with you.
And it would seem to me the situation with North Korea has gone so far beyond non-proliferation. Clearly, they have tested an H-bomb, and they've even threatened recently to test one in the Pacific, perhaps lobbing one on the tip of an ICBM. And I don't know quite exactly how they would explode it and where, but now things seem to have gotten out of hand on the political level in terms of leadership. And it seems that President Trump's taunting Kim Jong-un has resulted in a situation where, in many ways, the U.S. is looking as the aggressor and North Korea like the victim. And that's pretty much what their foreign minister says today, that he says that Trump has actually declared war on them by saying they are not going to be around much longer. Well, you could actually interpret that way. It's sort of... It's like going back to the early days of the Reagan administration in terms of the Cold War with the Soviet Union, where there was talk of ending up on the ash heap of history, which the old geriatrics in the Kremlin took literally. And decapitation strategies that Cap Weinberger talked about, they took that personally. So is that what's happening now? We're having a repeat of the worst kind of brinksmanship that we experienced in the Cold War?
Yes, I think it is. Or you could say it's like eighth graders on the playground taunting each other. And in a way, North Korea didn't have to say that this was a declaration of war. A lot of people don't realize that the Korean War has never officially ended. Technically, the Korean War is just at a stalemate. It's that we agreed to an armistice, to a ceasefire. But the war was never ended with a peace treaty.
So do you think that the U.S. is going to continue to fly bombers? The last time they flew the B-1 bombers with fighter escorts, normally they do it around just below the DMZ, but this last time apparently they took these bombers up the coast obviously off the 12-mile limit, but they still clearly were painted by North Korean radar. So do you think we're going to be doing that again?
I don't know. And as the foreign minister said today, under the current conditions, with it appearing that the United States is declaring war, they would feel justified in shooting down one of those B-1B bombers.
So if you were in the Pentagon and in the White House, what would your advice be, Phil Coyle?
Well, I'm not sure it would be heated the way things are going, but one of the things I would say would be, remember that we successfully achieved two agreements with North Korea, one to stop their nuclear program, which was effective for several years. In 94, that agreement lasted for several years. North Korea followed it, obeyed it. And we also reached a separate agreement to stop their long-range missile programs, an agreement that William Perry, former Secretary of Defense William Perry, had negotiated. Both of those agreements held for a while until political changes in the United States basically undermined them and they fell apart. But I think the first thing that the administration, current administration, needs to recall is that we did reach these agreements, so we know it's possible. It would be more difficult now because North Korea is much farther along. And in a way, we have wasted 15 years not talking to them, which North Korea has used to do more and more missile tests and now six underground nuclear tests.
So what was their earlier threat about detonating an H-bomb in the Pacific? Do you think that's sort of now on the back burner because it's been preempted by the declaration of war against the United States?
Not necessarily. You know, it may have been bluster along with all of the other bluster, but I don't think it's necessarily off the table. It certainly would get everybody's attention. You know, it would be a huge thing. There would be radioactive fallout. As President Trump himself said, the path of that fallout would be a path where you could track increased cancers. But I don't think it's necessarily off the table. For example, when China first became a nuclear power, the United States poo-pooed their capabilities and kept saying that they weren't a real nuclear power, not like us. Again, like kids on the playground. And China took that seriously, and they did a test where they launched a nuclear weapon on the end of a missile, simply to prove that they could do it and to get the rest of the world, especially including the United States, to take them seriously.
But the idea, though, of the North Koreans firing an ICBM and then having it go into a terminal phase somewhere in the Pacific, and I don't know how they'd warn ships and planes to get out of the way, and then detonating it atmospherically, which I understand was pretty much the assumption of what they're doing, that's pretty advanced technology, isn't it? Do you think they have that capability?
Well, I don't know for sure. Some of the missile tests they've done have been flawed, and one of their most recent tests in July appeared to break up on reentry. We have grainy television footage from Japan that makes it look like that missile, which was not carrying a real warhead, of course, broke up on reentry. So it appears they haven't solved all the problems that one needs to solve in order to have a viable, offensive missile-based nuclear program. But certainly time is not on our side. They are making progress.
Well, they could put a nuclear weapon on a fishing trawler and run it aground in Santa Monica Bay and blow up Los Angeles.
Well, that too. So, yes, I think we have to be worried about North Korea having these capabilities because there's more than one way to use them, as you say.
But at this point, the one factor that always strikes me as extraordinary in this, you talk about 8-year-old schoolboys taunting each other in the playground, the one thing that seems to be cavalierly ignored by President Trump are the South Koreans and the collateral damage to up to 10 million South Koreans in Seoul, maybe even more, with a conventional attack, which the North Koreans have a hair trigger preparation for. Even on top of that, President Trump has threatened to tear up the U.S.-South Korea trading deal. You'd think, if anything, we'd be bending over backwards to accommodate the fears of the South Koreans that they were going to end up the collateral damage in this schoolyard spat between Trump and Kim.
Yes, I didn't understand why President Trump would want to pick a fight with our friend and ally, South Korea, at a time when we need their help most in dealing with North Korea. President seems to have a tendency to do that. A different example is threatening to tear up the Iran nuclear deal, which I think is a very important agreement and has basically blocked Iran from getting nuclear weapons for as long as both sides sustain the agreement. But President Trump has picked a fight about that also. And it wasn't so very long ago that people used to say, well, there's no point in even trying to get an agreement with Iran. Iran will never agree to an agreement like this. Well, they did, just as in the past North Korea did also. So again, I want to say, we know it's possible. We've reached agreements like this with Iran and with North Korea twice. And as long as we're willing to sustain them, they help protect the United States.
So is there any scenario where you could, I recall Stephen Bannon's remarks in the interview that he did with the American Prospect that apparently got him fired or contributed to getting him fired from the White House, where he said there's no way you can have a war with North Korea because South Korea is within artillery range and you'd wipe out Seoul. So they've got us. Now, that happened shortly after Trump made his threat of fire and fury like the world has never seen, and that apparently did get Kim's attention, and he was he backed off a little bit. But then when Bannon made those remarks, then that undercut Trump, and so they were back at it, insulting each other. But so in terms of the extent to which, as Bannon says, they've got us, which is that the civilians in Seoul are held hostage, is there any way that the U.S. could remove that threat and the threat to U.S. civilians and military as well? Could you evacuate Seoul? My assumption would be that the minute you started to evacuate Seoul, the North Koreans would figure the U.S. is about to preemptively strike.
I think it's very difficult. It's like saying, could we evacuate New York or Chicago or Los Angeles? I suppose it's technically possible, but...
Certainly not at rush hour, right?
Yes.
Right. Yeah, well, it is obviously. I mean, it's an insane situation, but this is not out of the realm of possibility, is it? When you've got two people playing nuclear chicken, both of whom seem to have impulse control problems, and one of whom has indicated he's prepared to kill his uncle, his brother, using anti-aircraft artillery to blow people apart in public executions, et cetera, et cetera. So, you know, he's got some acts to back up his tough rhetoric. I'm not sure that Trump has. Certainly there's no indication that Trump is quite as brutal, but he seems to be pretty loose with his tongue.
Well, today in the White House press briefing, Sarah Huckabee Sanders said that... To think that President Trump had declared a war on North Korea was absurd. She emphasized that was absurd. And that may be helpful in toning down the back and forth fight. And I've been very hopeful from the way Secretary of State Rex Tillerson has handled himself. And in particular, he has said publicly, and through diplomatic channels to North Korea, that we're not interested in causing their regime to fail. We're not interested in attacking them, and that they should not feel threatened by the United States. And for a Republican administration, that's quite an interesting thing for the Secretary of State to say. In some past Republican administrations, the United States was much more hostile towards North Korea via the State Department and the rest of government. So I've been impressed with Secretary of State Tillerson and how some of the things he said about not wanting to attack or to have a fight with North Korea could be quite helpful.
Right, but again, isn't that undercut by his boss who speaks for the United States, the President of the United States, Donald Trump, who said at, in Huntsville, Alabama, at the Wernher von Braun Center, I might add, he said that they're not going to be around. He talked about both the North Korean country and the leadership. They're not going to be around much longer. How else could you interpret those words?
Yes, and he also said, we're going to handle it, whatever that meant.
Right.
Several times he says, we're going to handle that situation.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I think the question is it going to be two steps forward and one step back, or one step forward and two steps back? Through the Secretary of State, through regular diplomatic channels, with the help of North Korea and Japan and China, I think we can make progress here. And the fact that we've been able to do it in the past, I think, shows that we can do it again. Will it be easy? Not at all. Will it be much harder than in the past? Yes, because North Korea has made so much progress, they won't want to give up the progress they've made with rockets and missiles and nuclear weapons. But I think we really have no other choice.
Well, just in closing, there is some echoes, or at least there's an article by Steve Cole harking back to 1969 when President Richard Nixon unleashed B-52 bombers over North Vietnam because he was frustrated with the obstinate North Korean negotiators, because he wanted to get out of the war and they wanted it on their terms, not on Nixon's terms. So he decided to unleash B-52s, and he wanted to also signal to the Soviets that he was a little crazy.
Yeah.
Nixon told Haldeman, I call it the madman theory. We just slipped the word to them that, for God's sakes, you know Nixon is obsessed about communism. We can't restrain him, and he's angry, and he has his hand on the nuclear button. So Nixon used the idea that I'm a madman. Obviously, didn't necessarily work, but I'm not sure that this president we have now is, I think he's sincere in his recklessness and is an unguided missile, as opposed to cold and calculating like Nixon was.
Well, and I think some of the president's threats are also designed to try to move China. He's been, by all reports, he's been frustrated that China has not been more immediately helpful. China, of course, is famous in international policy for being incredibly patient, willing to take a very long time to consider things. And the president, from what we hear, is very frustrated with that.
Well, Philip Coyle, I suppose we should stay in touch. I'm not about to go into the bomb shelter, but this definitely is something that we don't need. And, you know, we've got some serious problems. The people in Puerto Rico, for example, are suffering greatly, and our president is running around insulting football players and North Koreans. But none of this rhetoric sounds like it's particularly helpful in terms of solving real-world problems.
Yes, I don't think we need to pick any more fights. We've picked quite enough, I think. You listed them there, and I don't think we need to pick any more.
Well, I thank you for joining us, Philip Coyle.
My pleasure.
And again, I've been speaking with Philip Coyle, who was Associate Director for National Security and International Affairs in the White House Office of Science and Technology Policy and Assistant Secretary of Defense and Director of Operational Test and Evaluation in the Department of Defense. With 40 years' experience in national security research, development, and testing matters, he is currently a Senior Science Fellow at the Center for Arms Control and Nonproliferation and the co-author of The Challenges of Nuclear Nonproliferation. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back looking into Sunday's extraordinary display of solidarity and indignation expressed by NFL players and owners in response to Trump's crude attack on Colin Kaepernick.
Oh, no. Oh, well, I ain't going to dirty war no more. Ain't going to dirty war no more. Ain't going to dirty war no more. Yes, war no more. Well, I ain't going to dirty war no more. Ain't going to dirty war no more. Ain't gonna do it. by the riverside, down by the
riverside. Don't wanna be an American idiot. Don't want a nation under the new media. And can you hear the sound of hysteria? The subliminal mind fuck America.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Ben Carrington, a professor in the Annenberg School of Communication and Journalism at the University of Southern California, where he teaches sociology. He previously taught at the University of Brighton in England and the University of Texas at Austin, and currently serves on the editorial boards of Identities, Global Studies in Culture and Power, the Journal of Sport and Social Issues, and the International Review for the Sociology of Sport. His latest book is Race, Sport, and Politics. Welcome to Background Briefing, Ben Carrington.
Hi, nice to join you.
Well, thank you, Ben. And race, sports, and politics could not be more apparent at this moment. President Trump was asked after his incendiary comments down at the Von Braun Center in Huntsville, Alabama, that has created a firestorm. And yesterday, Sunday, across the television, there was a manifestation of solidarity and indignation expressed by NFL players and owners alike. But the only comment we've heard from the president was asked by a reporter about the racial component to his statements, and he said this has nothing to do with racism. That's pretty hard to take, isn't it, given that most of the NFL players and NBA players are black, and the vast majority of the owners of both the NFL and the NBA are white?
Yeah, I mean, it's classic Trump, in as much as that he uses racially coded language, which sometimes is barely coded at all, and so that he can speak race without explicitly mentioning race. So you're absolutely right. The NBA is about 80, maybe 85% black. The NFL was about 65% black. And at least in the kind of popular imagination, especially with the NBA, like, these are known as predominantly black sports. And the athletes that he referred to, those sons of bitches, as he referred to them, nearly all of them, not exclusively, nearly all of the players that have been protesting have been African American. So that was clearly known to the audience. And so when Trump refers to our heritage in that speech, he's clearly talking about a white notion of American history and heritage. And when he refers to those sons of bitches, he's referring almost exclusively to black players. And then again, also, like, when he supposedly withdrew the invite to the to Steph Curry and the Warriors to visit the White House after their championship win last year, that's a predominantly black team. And so again, Trump is clever in his rhetoric, in as far as he can signal to his audience that he is invoking a white nationalist politics without ever explicitly saying so. And that allows him that kind of defense. And you saw it today from the press secretary at the White House. This notion that this had nothing to do with race. We didn't mention race. The only people who are injecting race into the conversation are the anti-racists, the activists, Black Lives Matter kind of activists, etc.
Well, when Trump tweeted out that if a player wants the privilege of making millions of dollars in the NFL or other leagues, he or she should not be allowed to disrespect our great American flag or country and should stand for the national anthem. If not, you're fired. Find something else to do. Bringing in the idea of privilege of making money, millions, again, predominantly black athletes, that has a whiff, doesn't it, of dog whistle, the idea that somehow you should be grateful and shut the hell up?
Absolutely. I mean, it's a version of saying these are uppity athletes who are getting above their station. They need to be put back into their place. And their place is to sing and to dance and to entertain and to run and to catch. The other part of, that has a long racist history of allowing black people, black bodies, a kind of a certain space within mainstream culture, as long as it's at the kind of behest and for the entertainment of white folks and white eyes. And the moment that those black entertainers or sports figures begin to make demands, they're very quickly shut down and explicitly said, no, shut up and play. Like we, and again, like this we is interesting as well. Like we pay you. And the notion here, I guess, is that Trump is aligning himself with the owners and all the fans, which is interesting as well. I mean, the other, if you go to any NFL game or NBA game, and I go to quite a few NBA games, I'm just struck by the difference, the kind of disjuncture between the predominantly white fan base of many of these teams and the overwhelmingly black sporting labor that you see on the court. And so when Trump says, you know, like, we're paying you, that we, I would argue, is a sense of white people here. Even, you know, either because I'm a fan who buys a jersey, or I'm a fan who is into fantasy football, I'm a fan who goes to games, or because I'm one of the owners, there's a sense that we own your body, and we can tell you what to do with it, and you know, and therefore any demands that you make outside the sporting field become illegitimate. And then the hour, like, I mean, that quote you just read out is really important, this kind of contrast between us and them. And the us is always inflected as the notion of this is white society, and this notion that we've given you a chance. I mean, the other part of it is this suggestion that you're lucky to have this chance. You should be grateful. And this goes way back, this discourse. I mean, you can trace it back, I think, to the early 20th century in Jack Johnson, the first black heavyweight boxing champion. And he was the one, so Jack Johnson was born in Galveston, Texas. And at the time in the early 20th century, black boxers weren't allowed to compete for the heavyweight championship of the world on the basis that white athletes were so obviously superior to black athletes that, you know, it would have been an insult to even allow a black boxer into the ring alongside a white boxer, especially for the heavyweight championship, which was supposed to be the kind of pinnacle of manhood. And Jack Johnson becomes the first world heavyweight champion. And in 1908, and when he does, there's this kind of cry that goes out for what's called the Great White Hope. And when we still use this term sometimes in kind of popular discourse, but many people don't know the origins of the term. So the Great White Hope was this notion that somewhere out there could be a white man strong enough to put Jack Johnson back in his place and to restore the racial order. Because, you know, it's hard to argue that whites are superior to blacks to kind of the ideology that underpins Jim Crow racism. If, you know, a Negro from Galveston, Texas, as the New York Times referred to Johnson as, you know, is beating up all these white guys in the ring in public. And so this kind of anxiety, I think, about black sporting achievement and black athletic success has a long history in the U.S. And that's and after Jack Johnson is finally defeated in 1915, the so-called color line is drawn. So it's literally black boxers can no longer compete for the heavyweight championship. And it's not until Joe Louis in the 1930s that you see another black champion emerge. But the key thing is that the criticism and the worry about Jack Johnson was that he didn't respect boundaries. You know, he kind of flaunted his wealth. He was outspoken. And from then on, you've had this kind of model that if black men are going to be allowed into our sports, you have to do so under the following conditions. You have to kind of be subservient. You can't speak out. You have to respect the rules. You, in a sense, you have to kind of disavow any sense of blackness, any sense of kind of radical politics, any sense of critical consciousness. And under those conditions, we'll accept you. And the moment that you err slightly, you're going to be subject to sanctions. Sometimes, you know, financial, but banning you from the sport or a kind of a pushback, which in a sense threatens your career. And so you've always had this kind of good black athlete, bad black athlete kind of discourse, or dichotomy rather, that it's been really hard for black athletes to kind of tread. And I think in many ways Muhammad Ali in the 1960s and other athletes kind of challenged that model, that to be a successful black athlete, you have to be subservient, you have to be quiet. And in I think this recent wave of critical consciousness of athletes, and particularly black athletes, from you know, going back to 2012 when the Miami Heat famously wore the hoodies to show solidarity for the family of Trayvon Martin when Trayvon Martin was killed, through to players like LeBron James wearing I Can't Breathe t-shirts, and other WNBA players also wearing Black Lives Matter t-shirts before games. You've had this kind of wave, which I think Colin Kaepernick, there's kind of crystallized around Colin Kaepernick's protest, but that's kind of fundamentally challenged this notion that black athletes should and must be quiet in order to play the game. And then finally, after many years, it seems like black athletes are finding their voice, and then the pushback, the kind of the backlash him. I actually think kind of very dangerous times, especially given the central place of sports to American culture, especially kind of American male culture. The kind of it's the spectacle of sport, and especially the spectacle of football, is so powerful in generating strong emotions of attachment and identity that if you know, in the midst of this, you kind of insert the explicit kind of race question. I think we're in very kind of combustible times.
And again, I'm speaking with Ben Carrington, a professor in the Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism at the University of Southern California, where he teaches sociology. And of course, in addition to Trump's remarks about calling Colin Kaepernick a son of a bitch and his tweets against Steph Curry, he also said that, in effect, these black athletes were showing total disrespect of our heritage, a total disrespect of everything that we stand for, adding for emphasis, everything that we stand for. So that was a really loud dog whistle, Ben. But in general, my sense is, I was watching television yesterday, which is a ritual, I think, for lots of people, lots of couch potatoes drinking beer. A lot of them are white, as you point out, and almost all the players are black. This could end up backfiring on Trump. The fact that the NFL owners, and again, of the 32 NFL teams, there are zero black owners. And in the NBA, Michael Jordan is the only black owner of a team. So what's your sense of that, the solidarity that was expressed by both the NFL players and the white owners?
Yeah, it's really interesting to see. And it's, so in normal circumstances, what Trump said at the weekend, especially when he personalized it in the language that he used, would normally have been a step too far, and there would have been a kind of backlash against Trump, and you know, and people who otherwise may have defended him or come to his side or supported him would have faded away. But there's been so many examples for the past 2 years when people have said, okay, this is it, this is the moment, and I like you. You attack John McCain's record as a war hero, or you attack the Pope, you know, or you admit on tape to sexual assault. I mean, we could just go on and on of the times in which there's been this kind of narrative that, okay, he's gone too far, and this notion of kind of middle America, this kind of the conservative person who maybe voted for Trump but wasn't fully ideologically behind him. Now, the argument that, you know, these aren't the Steve Bannons, the kind of Breitbart readers for whom Trump is their guy, the kind of the good but perhaps misguided middle America who will finally be kind of pushed. That hasn't happened, like, time and time again. So there appears to be a way in which people will square the circle and say, clearly you shouldn't be talking about sexual assaulting women, but hey, that's just locker room talk. Or, you know, that's just Trump. That's just Trump being Trump, and I kind of like the fact that he says it. And I think maybe the truth is, and maybe this is a bit scary for some of us to admit, that actually, at least in private, and there is a difference between the private and the public, I agree, but at least in private, I would guess that many people have referred to those protesting athletes as sons of bitches. And I wouldn't surprise me if many of the owners think the same thing, or said the same thing. So in a sense, so Trump articulates what the, I mean, just as an example, I mean, you talked to, I've watched the you know, the speech in Alabama a few times. The reaction of the crowd isn't one of horror. Yes, the crowd don't boo, or there's no gasp of, in terms of like what has Trump just said. Like, if you remember, like, there's a part of it in the middle where the crowd starts chanting USA, USA, USA. This kind of, you know, especially coming from Europe, now, these fascistic moments when there's a mobilization of very powerful identities around nationalism and race in a sporting setting. And so actually, although it's true that some of the owners, and indeed some of the owners who've actually donated to Trump over the years, came out and showed solidarity with their players and locked arms, I'm not so sure. I think it would be a mistake to read those moments as kind of an anti-Trump moment. There's certainly, like, the NFL is a business. Let's not forget this, yes? Like, the NFL is a business. And Trump effectively, although he walked it back a little bit today, was effectively calling for a boycott of a business over the weekend. So if that's your business, you're not going to come out and say, like, yes, you should boycott my business. I would like to go out of business. So, I mean, let's be quite clear here. There's a financial logic and a financial imperative of the NFL owners kind of collectively to kind of push back at least, or at least to show kind of solidarity. And it's also the case, I mean, and there are different dynamics between the NBA and the NFL. Maybe we could talk about that, but historically, at least, the NFL players, an NFL player doesn't have the same power as the NBA players. But what Trump managed to do spectacularly was to kind of unify and to produce solidarity amongst NFL players, which normally isn't there. They don't have the same guaranteed contracts. The squads are much bigger. I mean, it's easier to mobilize 15 to 16 to 17 to 18 NBA players on a squad than it is to mobilize 60, 65, 70 football players on a squad. Now, the units are much tighter in the NBA. There's a much higher percentage of African Americans, and a few players on the NBA and on the NBA team have enormous power within the organization. That's not quite the same in the NFL. And interestingly, actually, the players that tend to have the most power in the NFL locker rooms are often quarterbacks, often white quarterbacks, and many of them quite conservative quarterbacks. So spectacularly, Trump has managed to unify quite a kind of politically disparate and racially more diverse NFL locker room alongside the owners, but I think for very different reasons. It will be interesting to see what happens in the coming days and weeks as the season develops. But yes, there is a degree of solidarity, but I think it isn't so much an anti-Trump kind of moment. And especially then, you get this kind of confusing moment where, you know, what does it mean to kind of lock arms? Now, the Kaepernick kind of protest was to kneel. There's still kind of an embrace of the flag and nationalism in those moments of unity amongst some of these teams and their owners. But I also do think, like, the honest answer is we don't know where this is going to go. I mean, if we've learned anything from Trump and the ways in which we would normally read politics, is that we simply don't know. That makes it kind of exciting and interesting, but it also makes it hugely unnerving. And I can imagine now the NFL owners are really worried about where this might go next. Because a sport which for so long was one of the most conservative sports, yes, it was a sport which, despite its rhetoric, the owners wield a lot of power. The players can lose their jobs, you know, relatively easily, and it's never allowed the type of kind of political articulations that you see in other sports. That's all changed now, so we really are in uncharted territory.
Well, we've run out of time, but it's a bit of an irony that the speech down in Huntsville, Alabama, was in the Von Braun Center, named after Wernher von Braun, whose V-2 rockets rained down on England during World War II, something I'm sure you're quite aware of, Ben. And it does seem extraordinary that in the broad context that Donald Trump has insulted so many people, but the only people he hasn't insulted, in fact he's praised, are neo-Nazis and Vladimir Putin. So go figure.
very fine people, as he would call them, yes.
Well, I thank you for joining us. I appreciate it.
My pleasure.
And again, I've been speaking with Ben Carrington, who's a professor in the Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism at the University of Southern California, where he teaches sociology. He previously taught at the University of Brighton in England and the University of Texas at Austin, and currently serves on the editorial boards of Identities, Global Studies in Culture and Power, the Journal of Sports and Social Issues, and the International Review for the Sociology of Sport. And his latest book is Race, Sport, and Politics. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.